Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I am Kim.
And I'm Kara.
And today we are talking to two very special people, JC Dugard and Dr. Rebecca Bailey.
I'm so excited for this interview and to share it with everyone. Holy cow.
It was such a good conversation. And we honestly could have talked for hours, I think. And there will probably be a part two and maybe even some further conversations and collaborations. I just can't wait to see what comes out of this. But you may have heard of JC Dugard. She is the survivor of kidnapping. She spent 18 years in captivity at the hands of two strangers. Since her rescue in 2009, she's used her freedom and voice to spread her unique survivor experience. JC's the founder of the JACE Foundation, which she started to help other families that have suffered a familial or non-familial abduction or other trauma, and has created educational programs and encourages the collaboration of various entities to provide protected, safe spaces for families to heal. JC's also the author of A Stolen Life and Freedom, My Book of Firsts, both memoirs that she wrote herself detailing her 18 years in captivity, eventual rescue, and recovery process. She's spoken at many venues across the country and hopes to continue writing. An important goal of hers is to educate the media and the helping professions that the term Stockholm Syndrome was a media-driven term and is degrading and insensitive to survivors and their families. JC enjoys spending time with her family and her faithful four-legged companions in California, and this is where Dr. Bailey comes in.
So recently, she started the Polyvagal Equine Institute with longtime friend Dr. Rebecca Bailey and equine expert Margie McDonald.
They're excited to share educational programs, videos, and workshops that focus on incorporating horses with the polyvagal theory.
So, introducing Dr. Rebecca Bailey, she is a PhD and a leading family psychologist and equestrian who's become a world-renowned professional teacher, speaker, author, and entrepreneur. She's the founder of Transitioning Families, a group of independently licensed mental health practitioners dedicated to Bailey's innovative ideas for helping families through crisis and difficult change. She's best known for her work with survivors of non-familial abduction and is on the advisory board of the JACE Foundation. Together with JC, they've created an innovative model which utilizes horses to help teach and educate judges, police officers, therapists, and other professionals about compassion, kindness, and connection.
This is one of the things that Dr. Bailey and JC made a connection on very early in their relationship.
She's the creator of the Polyvagal Equine Institute and Connection Focused Therapy, an organization dedicated to equine-assisted psychotherapy and education with a focus on applying Dr. Stephen Porges' research on the autonomic nervous system to a variety of populations. She believes that understanding the interaction between the nervous system and our thoughts and actions is key to compassionately responding to and addressing the complexities of today's societal demands. She's appeared on numerous network shows, including Anderson Cooper and ABC's 2020. A graduate of the Wright Institute in Berkeley, California, Dr. Bailey was raised in the Boston area, but relocated to California 35 years ago. She now lives in Northern California with her loving husband and countless animals.
All right. We are here today with my dear friends, Dr. Rebecca Bailey and JC Dugard, and we cannot wait for you to hear this conversation. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Bailey and JC. We are so glad to talk to you today.
Welcome, ladies.
We're excited to be here, too.
We are so glad to see you guys and happy to be here and looking forward to the conversation.
Now, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you all met Kara to kick it off?
So we met Kara at the Maloof Foundation, earlier this year. It hit it off right away because obviously we have something in common. That's not pleasant, but still we have that in common that we were both kidnapped. I think we also bonded over the fact that Rebecca and I are writing a paper about appeasement and how Stockholm Syndrome is really degrading to us survivors, and we need to change the verbiage and language around how we view and address and talk about survivors of these kinds of crimes. So,
and I think I met you before, didn't I? We met in Long Beach or somewhere maybe. I know I met you before Maloof, because somehow I was following your Instagram and your I hope I can say this, your kick-ass workouts. So you were like a lit up there. And so
I'm not sure. That may be right.
I don't know. I had some vague memory because I am lucky enough to have not gone through what you guys have been through, which is probably why I can work effectively, because for some reason I have a weird, uncanny ability to understand, but understand that it's not about me or anything that I've had to experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. So we always do an icebreaker. I don't feel like we necessarily need it, but it's just always a fun thing to start the conversation before we get into the real conversation. And that is, tell me what is the last thing that you binge watched or listened to, whether it's an audiobook or a podcast or a TV show. What is the last thing that you binged?
Well,
The Dirty Secret.
That would be Dallas, the new.
No.
Which one?
Dynasty.
Dynasty. Sorry. Yeah. Dynasty, not Dallas, because that's really, really old. But they did a new remake of Dynasty, and there's a character named Fallon in it, and she is just amazing. And she loves horses.
And we're both obsessed with it. And then I was in, I was at this event for the Polyvagal Institute, and I met this other lady who was absolutely obsessed with Fallon. So if you have not experienced Fallon, you've got to watch the remake of Dynasty. Because she's really, really cool.
It's really, really
That's
good.
On my list now. And you've both been watching it?
Oh, yeah.
We're done.
It was over.
We grieved separately in separate houses when it was over because it was so sad.
Yeah.
There's no hope for a remake.
No, it really, really did end. Like, you know, when a series ends, it just ends. So now I'm into Christmas movies.
Fair. Yep.
The craftier, the better.
Yep.
I'm into White Lotus.
Yep. Yes. Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's very dramedy and campy. I don't know how else to
just like everybody.
It.
Like they make it so there's not like one character you really like. And even if you do for a minute, you're like, no, I really don't like her. It's really interesting.
But Jennifer Cooley, I swear, literally everything she touches turns to gold. And every time my kids see her on, there's an Old Navy commercial right now where she's like playing the piano or something. And every time that they see her, they're like, I'm taking the dog.
What a career. I don't know. Like I get into sort of psychologically sort of wanting to analyze if she's really confident or mocking herself because she isn't. And then I'm like, just watch her. She's a character. That's all she is. You don't need to analyze. You don't need to get in touch with her and see if you can help her self-esteem. Just watch.
I imagine that kind of show watching with you would be akin to me watching anything that has to do with courtroom drama alongside Mike and for Kara, any kind of military movie with Joe.
Yeah. Or like anything law enforcement, just with me in general. I'm like, that's not how it works. That's not right.
Yeah, I know.
Just let me be entertained.
Oh, I know. Well, for those who are not familiar to your comfort level and as much as you want to talk about, can you give us a brief overview of your survivor story?
Yeah, so for those that don't know, I was kidnapped when I was 11 from my school bus stop. I was held captive for 18 years, had two children by my captor. Somehow I survived and I was rescued with my two daughters in 2009. And from there, you know, I was free, you know, it was hard at first. I really needed a lot of support. And of course my whole family did. I hadn't seen my mom in a really long time, obviously. And, the rest of my family and then my daughters had never met their grandma. So we really needed some help coming together. And the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children hooked us up with Dr. Rebecca Bailey, who's right here. And we just really hit it off. She was already working with horses and she had dogs and cats. And I've always really been a big animal lover. And I just, you know, fell in love with what she was doing and how she was helping other people coming back from trauma situations. And after my therapy, I really wanted to give back to others that had been through maybe not the same circumstances, but similar. So we created the Jace Foundation together, and we support families that are coming out of severe crisis through therapy, different types of therapy, because not all the same therapy helps everybody. So I wasn't the type to just want to sit in a room and talk to a therapist. What was different about Rebecca was that we hiked together. She had her husband do cooking classes. My kids and my mom and family were doing equine therapy together. So it really takes a lot, I think, when somebody comes out of severe crisis. So do you want to add to any of that?
JC and her family were amazing. And through some universal force bigger than myself, they ended up in the program that I'd pretty much established. Well, I established it in 2006. Very much out of the box, doing things like we call side-by-side hiking for therapy, cooking together, eating the animals, all of that. Because over the years, I'd found that therapy is wonderful and there's all sorts of wonderful pieces of it, but sitting in the office is not right for everybody. There's so much importance about moving and getting out there. Mm-hmm. I will also say, JC is an amazing person, as are all of you guys who've, you know, who come back from these extreme situations and, you know, say, I'm not going to be knocked down by this. I'm going to keep going. But JC and her family were pretty amazing. And there were so many dynamics and so much strength with all of them when we came together that I was so lucky to have had right program for the right family.
Well, and you tailor make them to the family. So that, I think that's a big difference in how therapy should really be, like it should be tailored to the person that needs it instead of the other way around. Like there's just not one box that fits everyone.
Yeah. Well, and not to get too ahead of ourselves, but I'm hearing you talk about a lot of different things that you can be doing while addressing therapeutic interventions. Do you see that as some sort of or a form of EMDR? Because you're talking bilateral stimulation is what came to mind when you're doing hiking and walking. And so you've got something else to focus on while you're almost rewiring that trauma. Can you kind of speak to that?
I think that's true, but I really believe in the power of human connection. And I think even with EMDR, yes, there's all sorts of stuff going on in the brain, et cetera, but the real thing is the power of connection from one human being to another. And for some people with EMDR, the first step of developing a trusting relationship is this connection. People always ask me about sort of even brain mapping and all that stuff. And I, you know, I'm not a neuropsychologist, I'm a psychologist. But all these years later, what I've really, really come to believe is it's the power of helping vulnerable people access their strength. And yes, I'm sure the bilateral stimulation, I mean, we're all about horses, that there's some piece there, I'm sure there is. But the real piece is just building a trusting relationship, which is the challenge with managed care and the challenge with the push for evidence-based protocols. We miss this incredible, important healing power of one heart to another, basically a ventral vagal, that social connection.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's so important, just the ability to connect with one person, because you definitely don't want to get vulnerable if you're not comfortable with that person, right? So doing something like hiking, it allows you, I feel, if you're not comfortable with being vulnerable, it removes some of that awkwardness also, because you're not feeling like that person's staring at you, right? You don't have to make eye contact. You can just walk beside them and go at your own pace, right? And then if you have to slow down, you're like, oh, I'm out of breath, right? Like you have a built-in excuse, like you're hiking.
And if you feel like you're saying something that you know, might necessarily be, you think you're going to shock the other person or might not be comfortable, you know, walking side by side is kind of that same idea of like, you know, I don't have to look at this person while I'm saying this, but I can get it out.
Yeah.
Because eye contact can be very important, but it can also activate a shutdown. It can activate what we call either the dorsal vagal shutdown, or it can activate a sympathetic arousal system. So we're fight flight. And so we take it for granted. There are a lot of people that really have a challenge looking at people in their eyes. And what I've noticed with much of the work I've done is sometimes it takes a long time for that a person to be comfortable. I know the other thing, JC and I laughed a lot. We laughed more than you could ever imagine when we were hiking. We just had a silly sense of humor about stuff. And to be honest, it's easy for me to say because I wasn't trapped in a backyard for 18 years, but the absurdity of this couple that kept her and their thought processes and how they were, I was so excited when you finally said what?
That it was nice to have somebody to laugh about those kind of things with.
Well, when you said to me, I really think he was crazy. Oh. And I was like, oh my God, thank God. Because
well,
you know.
The first question that I asked her when we first met was, do you think he was crazy? Because it's a long, complicated story. And you can read about it all in my book. But basically, all I heard was that people were believing his story and that he was this changed man and all this stuff about schizophrenia, like he had overcome schizophrenia and all this stuff. So, you know, my perspective being in the backyard trapped, you know, he was getting all this feedback from other people that he was doing this amazing work of God and just this amazing guy. And so when I finally got the chance to ask a professional, you know, was this man crazy? And she didn't answer me. It was really frustrating because she wanted to give me the opportunity to come to my own conclusion. But at the time, like, I just wanted somebody to say, yeah, he was crazy.
Right.
But she didn't do that. But eventually we came to the point where I said, I'm like, you know, I've come to my own conclusion. He was crazy. I don't care what anybody
so
else.
So excited.
What anybody else is saying or has said or is going to say. You know, he is absolutely, you know, crazy.
I have a confession.
And then she could say it too.
I have a confession.
Yeah.
So you made me read all his stuff. Mm-hmm. I only read like one page.
Oh.
I was like, I'm not going into this brain. I mean, I scanned it, admittedly. I scanned it, but I was like, I'm not going there. But I still remember we were walking along and you said, I think he's crazy. And I was like,
yeah.
Yay! It was so important, but it was really important that I didn't challenge that at first. Mm-hmm. And because I could see how he wove this world, you know, and there were people that signed petitions of his. And, you know, he even, I can say this, he even went into the FBI office with a whole document. And they probably knew in their hearts he was cuckoo. But they acted as if they didn't, you know, they took right. his manifesto or right. whatever it right. was. So I can see why she really thought that. And he conned the probation officers, conned his therapist. Mm-hmm. So I want to be, you know, honest and fair to you, Jay, that I can understand why you would have been like, because you told me, why do all these people think that he's like
yeah,
making sense?
Yeah, it made no sense to me. Like, I mean, I always thought he was crazy, but then you hear, you know, that people actually believe in something that he's saying. And so you get kind of confused in your brain and it gets jumbled of how you feel.
And he let you, you know, I remember, and, you know, you can kick me if this is too much, but I just remember you said that when he finally got let off of.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, say that. I mean, you don't have to say that, but I'd rather you say it.
So the background of Philip Garrido is he was arrested, put in jail, prison, really, for 10 years. I might be wrong on the timing on this. And then he got out. He kidnapped me, but he was on parole. From the federal government because he went out of state to kidnap Katie Calloway. And that's why he was in prison for the, and then he got off on good behavior. then he proceeded to kidnap me. And then for, I want to say another 10 years, he was still on parole for the federal government. And then he got an announcement that he was going to be let off. He was going to be paroled and like, no supervision or anything like that. And I just remember getting this, like he was happy and like I had to act like I was happy for him because that's what we did. Protection. We pretended a lot about, his feelings were up, you know, what was important. But inside, like, I just remember feeling like, oh my God, nobody's really looking for me anymore. Nobody's looking at him. Nobody's going to see the things that he's doing. And just getting this sinking feeling. And then he got a notice that the state of California was going to pick him up for parole. And I was so happy. I was so happy, on the inside, of course. But it turned out, like, none of his parole officers really noticed that we were around. I mean, even the kids were in the house and, like, they never got noted. I mean, he just always talked his way out of every situation. So I really felt like this is just hopeless. Like, everybody's going to believe him. Even if something happens, like, nobody's going to believe me, you know? And it was just one of those sinking feelings.
I think it's why we resonate so much with what you're doing with your podcast, which is the meaning, so much of, like, what happens with victims, survivors, whatever word we're using, is that so much of it is about the perpetrator, right? And people forget to slow down. Like, what is the meaning when somebody's taken off of probation? Like, you know, or what does it mean when there is an adjudication? And part of what JC and I are working with our Polyvagal Equine Institute is we're working on helping people train to be able to testify. So, like, young girls or older girls or boys, whoever it is, being able to manage their nervous system enough to sit on a stand and testify, because it is so important. The law enforcement piece has always been a really big, important part of my work and my job. JC and I have also been training police officers with the horses to help them with their nervous system. But that's why we resonate so much with you. And I know you want to get a word in here. So sorry.
No, I think it's just so interesting. And knowing that, JC, you don't do interviews very often. And I know that when you do things, Dr. Bailey's here with you. And I'm always glad to have her here with you, because it's kind of like we get a little bit more inside what's going on and what is most interesting to us, kind of to what you said, Dr. Bailey, is that it's not what the offender did to us, right? It's not, that's not the thing that's interesting. It's what happened between our ears. It's us. It's how we went on to keep moving, to heal. And then after all of those things, now what we're doing. So I think it's just so interesting to sit here with you guys and have this conversation, because it's everything that we're about.
Well, and as fascinated as people are with the offenders in the true crime genre, what I find to be the most intriguing is exactly what you're talking about. It's the psychology that takes place in our brains as survivors. And that's something that everyone is capable of. Everyone will have some kind of response, whereas not everyone is going to be a sadistic criminal. But your responses, you can learn so much from listening to the people who have gone through this and helping either prepare yourself or support others.
And, you know, it could sound creepy that JC sits with her ex-therapist, Dr. Bailey. And I know that there are sometimes people that are like, what is it? JC and I, about 2 years after, or 2.5 years, she really said to me, I really want my story I want to be known for me and what I do, not for what happened. And so we spent like 6 months, you know, talking about what that meant, really had felt that she had done a whole lot of really good therapy. I mean, we spent a lot of hours together with the horses and the hiking. We really like working together. We really have a message. We really recognize the impact. I'm actually more comfortable with public speaking because I don't have to bare my soul when I go out and do it like you guys do sometimes. But we just really enjoy each other. And, you know, like the two of you, you know, we will go out and accidentally buy the same purse on the same day without knowing the other one. You know what I mean? And sometimes even we ride horses and we ride at separate barns, and sometimes at the same barn, we'll look and we'll be like, wait, is that me or you? And it's not a merging weird thing. It's just we really And I don't know where it came from, but there's some reason that we were thrown together on a path. That's all I can say.
Yeah, we really learned that we had a lot in common. And I really did want to be more than just my story. Like, it's always been really important to me to continue to figure out why I did things and why I didn't do other things. And so I knew that that part of me wasn't going to just go because I wasn't, you know, getting regular therapy. I really needed somebody to mentor me through what my new life of freedom looked like. You know, I needed support and a different kind of friendship than I would have been able to get otherwise.
I remember when she asked me to go on Diane Sawyer with her, and it was really about, I want them to see how healthy I am. You know, you can't meet JC without knowing that. But I think it was Chris Cuomo, maybe, that we needed a little bit of like, wait, slow down at one point, not about you, but sort of there was something that came up about family where, and I remember feeling like that was such a cool thing. Like, it wasn't like, come on the interview because I want them to hear about my psychological process. She's like, I just want somebody else to say, yeah, look at her. She really is as strong as she is.
Well, and I think another thing is you don't want to talk about my story or anything to do with me without us doing it together.
Yeah, I won't do
which
that.
Which is, yeah. You know, one of the reasons why I trust her so much. You know, I knew she was, you know, that confidentiality that we shared wasn't just going to end because, you know, she's my mentor.
Is this a bad time to tell you about the movie, about the movie rights that I just sold?
Yeah.
That was one time.
Damn it.
Well, and I think that's so important too, because we talk about consent and like representation in this whole true crime world. And so many people feel like, oh, well, I'm getting it from a secondhand source or somebody who was maybe, covering the story as it was happening, like somebody with the local paper, a podcaster that sat in court. And it's not the same. It's not the same as having that survivor or their family's consent and their ability to talk about it and maintain the autonomy over that story and that narrative.
Right. You know, and that's one of the things, I don't know why I'm bringing this up, but one of the things with the Jace Foundation, like, we don't have a lot of coverage out there, and like, there's not a real lot to talk about because the families that come to us, like, we don't want to talk about what's going on with them and what's, you know, what kind of therapy they had. And so, you know, getting funding for that type of work has been a real challenge.
Yeah.
Because you can't talk about it like you can with saving animals. You know, you can tell the animal story because, you know, it's sad and it's not confidential, you know, but when you're telling the story of a family or an individual that has gone through, you know, just horrendous things, like, you can't just share that on Facebook and say, hey, guess what the Jace Foundation just did, you know, like, so that's been a real challenge in how to fund, you know, the families that come to us.
Well, and also, I mean, the protected space, as I mentioned, we work with some police officers, police departments, judges, things like this. I don't even like to say that, because the whole idea of a protected space is a space where you're, you know, giving them privacy and the...
You're not exploiting that, that they came, or like, you know, oh, we just got this police department, look at us, you know, so it's been a real challenge. But we've done it for 13 years now, and, you know, we're still doing it to the best of our ability in this interesting world that we're living in.
Yeah. I was thinking as you were talking, though, that exactly what you said about the confidentiality, and you said, you know, we can't share that. The thing is, there are people out there who are like, we can share that. It's public information, right? And so that whole mentality is really the reason that Kim and I wanted to start a podcast, because we were like, we want to be a podcast by survivors, about survivors, and for survivors, right? So we want to be a platform where we are getting people's consent and we're not telling JC's story, you know, without her being here. And so that's something that we're very passionate about. And so and I know that was one of the things also that Jay, you and I bonded over when we met, is how people want us to come and talk about our story. And that was one of the things that I liked about the Maloof Summit, is it was about something other than, hey, here's this thing that happened to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Like I used to do those type of, you know, fundraisers for other people to raise money for the Jace Foundation, because it was a way for me to raise money. But it just got really too hard to tell my, because, you know, I feel like they just wanted to hear my entire story. And it just got really hard for me. And I, not even hard, but just, I just was done. You know, I really wanted to move into the future in a different way. Like, I've done things since I've been kidnapped, you know. I've mm-hmm. created the foundation, created the Polyvagal Equine Institute. We're creating these amazing videos to share our love of horses and the power of what horses can teach us with everybody. And there's a lot more to me and to any of us that have become survivors than just what happened to us.
Interesting what JC just said too, because the first 5 years of my life, you guys are going to laugh, but I was almost abducted by her story, you know, my whole life. And yes, I was, but my whole life, I mean, the first year she was here, the paparazzi was after us, knocking on the door, going to my son, who at the time was 14, and, you know, pretending they were the FBI, and like a lot changed. I had to cut off most of my private practice. And I'm not saying that as boo-hoo. I mean, I slept in a nice bed and I wasn't being tortured or all sorts of the stuff you guys went through, but it was really interesting. And what it really brought up to me was how important a really good protected space is for survivors. And even if you don't have a therapist, I mean, you know, I know some other more high profile people didn't go into therapy, but they went into a community where they were kept in a good way from the, you know, protected.
Not in a backyard, kept. Yeah. Okay, got it. Not against their will.
Important that in people need to be left alone. They need to be left, and they need to be. It's hard because on one level, you need the press sometimes to actually get proper adjudication and to get recognition, but you also need just time to just have people back off.
There is a right and a wrong way how the meat handles.
And some of the agencies, I mean, I think that advocacy is incredibly wonderful, but what we also found was a lot of different organizations that had different ideas of what was right for JC and her family, and like even things initially like vaccinations. She had a right to decide if she wanted to vaccinate, and this is before COVID, right? And, you know, ultimately she did, of course, but it was her decision.
But the way it was presented, it felt like it was a dire situation that needed to be handled right away, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't presented like, you know, these are options. You have this option, you have this option, or you can do none of the above. So I think, you know, we just need to be careful.
Yeah. In my experience, one of the things that I tell people that I'm working with daily when they're trying to figure out, like, how do I take my life back? How do I move from victim to survivor? And that's exactly what you said. It's making decisions for yourself. You know, whether it's I had a sexual assault nurse examiner one time who sent me a message and said, how do I approach someone who comes in and changes their mind and doesn't want to complete the exam, knowing if they walk out the door, so does likely any chance of prosecution. And I said, honestly, you kind of have to let them go because this is very likely their first time making a decision for themselves. So anytime a survivor, especially someone who has been kidnapped, held against their will for any survivor, but I would think someone who has not had a choice for themselves for so long, in order to start unpacking that, it's like you have to begin making decisions for yourself. Anytime someone is making those decisions for you, it just feels a little bit like they're just not giving you the will to make decisions. And so I think that's just so important.
From day one, I would ask Jay what she wanted. Like, do you want juice or you want water? And it used to really piss her off, you know? And I think that's one thing my field has to learn. We are not the experts in you guys. We have theories. It's like, but we weren't there. We don't know how you survived. We need to listen to you and support you guys. And that's like, so I think it gets so confused. And my field as a psychologist is a very male-dominated field, and there really is a male-dominated perspective of trauma treatment. And it comes from a well-meaning side. They mean well, but there's a way that we still perpetuate the fragile little victim. And I'm like, are you kidding? Like when I have somebody in my office who's been through violent assaults or whatever this is, or natural disaster, I'm like blown away to be in the presence of a goddess or God. I'm like, holy cow. I hear these stories and I don't feel like, oh, poor you. I just like, wow, what can I learn from you? And I'm a little narcissistic, so that if I'm ever in that situation, I might get through. You know, sometimes
but that's exactly why you talk about it too. Because the more that you know ahead of time and the exposure to these kinds of stories from the source, it's not narcissistic to think that, oh my gosh, something may stick and I may do one extra thing that helps with, say, a prosecution or even just healing down the road.
Exactly.
Kara, when you were just talking about the sane nurse, that jogged a memory loose that I didn't even know I had. And I'm not sure exactly where I was, but it was a victim advocate on the day of my assault telling my parents to let me make even the smallest choices. And so they asked me, like, what do you want for dinner? And all they wanted was for me to pick what I wanted for dinner that night. I have no idea what I said. But that just popped back into my mind. And it is those little choices that we slowly get to start making again.
It's so interesting because when in 2009, people weren't doing that. And I really like to believe that the work we did and some of the education we did for some of the federal agencies helped people understand that. That, you know, I really do.
I think
because
it's very
initially when we came,
yeah,
they were telling us everything she had to do and who they needed to talk to. And, you know, the other piece that when there's a missing child recovered or a missing adult, a lot of understandable parents believe that maybe the perpetrator took their child. And so there was a lot of pressure for her to talk to people. And I was like, I mean, it's a good thing I'm such a bossy babe, because I had to be really strong. I had to be really strong with her telling me to and tell people back off, because there was so much, there was like guilting of, you know, well, she must know something of which, you know, she didn't.
I didn't know of any other crime that he had committed. Even the one, you know, that he had committed years before me, I didn't know anything about it, except that he was on parole for doing something bad.
I'm so glad that we kind of touched on this fact that we all want to try to prepare in some way for like bad things that happen. I think that's a very common concept for a lot of women. And I think that's why a lot of women specifically consume true crime, is they listen, they want to know how can they prepare themselves. Of course, I'm sure you've gotten questions like that before, but I always counter that question with this idea that we all have systems within us that are meant to help us survive. And that is so much of what you two together do work on, is this idea of a fourth trauma response. So we all know fight, flight, freeze. And sometimes we hear this word fawn, but no one really likes the word fawn. And so what you guys are doing is raising awareness and doing research around the appease response and how it's not actually Stockholm syndrome. It's not fawning. It's actually an appease response. And I would love to hear the two of you speak on your work around that and what you've discovered, because it's definitely something that resonates with Kim and I.
Do you want to start?
Why don't you start and then I'll give my fawning lecture.
Okay. So, you know, I was probably labeled with Stockholm syndrome when, you know, I was first recovered. You know, why didn't I leave? Why didn't she leave? Questions pop up. I mean, even though, you know, it's really degrading for me, it's really degrading for my family as well. Like to even have the concept or the notion that, oh, why wouldn't JC leave that situation if she had the chance, you know? And it wasn't about that. Like I couldn't leave. I was kidnapped when I was 11 years old. I was stuck in a little room by myself. Philip was my only source of food, bathroom, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, it gets psychologically, it gets in your head and you have a feeling of helplessness in a lot of ways. But there was no chance for me to get away either. I mean, this man was three times my size. I didn't know what he would do to me if I did try to get away. But with all that to consider, like, there was no part of me throughout the 18 years that was ever in love with him. And I think that's where Stockholm syndrome comes from, is like you love your perpetrator, you become in love with your perpetrator. There is no part of me whatsoever that ever loved him. You know, there was a lot of me that had to go in and act like I liked him And, you know, later on when I had kids, you know, it became even more so because I didn't know what he would do, you know, to me or to them at any given time. He was so unpredictable, so violent, and just unpredictable. And to me, that was the scariest part, was the unpredictability. Mm-hmm. So when I was later recovered and had time to think about and asking Rebecca, and we pondered all these questions and like, how did I survive? How did I know to appease him in a way that he didn't do certain things? Or, you know, it's hard to explain. But we did a lot of research and we found Dr. Stephen Porges, who founded the polyvagal theory. And it's all about a feeling of safety. Like you have to have an internal sense of safety, that like there's different states that you go in throughout the day. Ventral connection, sympathetic is fight or flight, dorsal is when you shut down. And there was no time that I felt like, I mean, there was times that I was shut down, like in a dorsal state, but I was aware of everything that was going on. And later on, I think that's why I was able to write my book, because I did remember every single thing that happened during my kidnapping. But I really wanted to understand, like, why didn't I try more to leave? Was I really scared? You know, that kind of thing. And so this polyvagal theory really gave me the verbiage to be able to explain what was happening to me. It wasn't a conscious decision that I was making about what to do. It was an unconscious decision and something that I just was doing to survive.
So in a nutshell, the polyvagal theory, Porges' theory, what he did was he found out that there's not just fight, flight, freeze, that there's a social connection that comes from a different part of the vagal pathways. Vagal nerve is the longest of the cranial nerve in the body, and it goes through all different organs. It's very, very important, and you can read up about it pretty quickly and at least get a nutshell. But what he said is that social connections are what all mammals evolved to need each other and to depend on each other. And to have a social connection, you need to be in a calm enough state. So when JC and I first started talking about this, I was looking at my whole theory from my graduate school was around learned helplessness, Martin Seligman's theory, that people just give up. But when I started meeting people like you guys and JC and Elizabeth and all of these type of people, I started saying, no, this is not a helplessness. There's something else going on. So what Jay left out was she, in a conversation on an airplane, said to me, because we have weird conversations as we're traveling. And she said, I think I learned to think like a predator, but act like prey. And I was like, wow. Sure. And so that statement that then we took to Porges, who said, okay, let's talk about it. We were looking at the word adaptation. And then he, through looking at animal models of behavior, said, look at appeasement. Appeasement is what one nervous system will do to help calm another nervous system down. Now, the danger is to ever sound like it's a conscious act, or that anybody that is killed or tortured or raped, you know, in any way could have stopped it. So I'm going to roll into fawning. Fawning is a perpetrator's perspective. In my mind, the last thing we need is something else where a defense attorney can say you were fawning and therefore you deserved it. So I'm like, let's get rid of fawning. Fawning was not a word until 3 years ago. It came up in the trauma literature. There are some cultures in which people are taught to fawn. You know, that it's part of the innate culture, but that's not what we're talking about. There is a hypothesis that when one animal fawns with an aggressor, the animal will become more aggressive. Now, JC and I, again, because we're a little geeks, we're trying to look at the data to prove that last week. We weren't accessing an article to show that, but we've all seen a dog with another dog. If the dog is aggressive and the animal fawns like a little, they'll get worse. So that's not appeasement. I think that's really important. Appeasement is a superpower that comes from the ability to go from a dorsal shutdown, deep terror, disassociated state up through sympathetic into ventral vagal and connect through nonverbal communication with the aggressor to calm them down. Sorry, I just...
No, that's great.
No, go off. That was amazing.
That's a great explanation.
Yeah. And I'm just even thinking through my experiences and kind of the things that were going on in my brain, what I wanted my captor to think was not that I was weak and not that I was rolling over, but that I was going with what he wanted.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that I was not causing a rub with him. Right.
Yes. I'm going to do exactly what you want me to do. And I'm not going to hold. Mine was, he didn't want to be a bad person. And so, you know, I'm comforting him like, you know, it's okay. Everybody makes mistakes, and making sure that he knew, you know, I wasn't going to tell anybody. And, you know, this would just really destroy my feeling. It is an appeasement. It is thinking like, oh my gosh, when you said learn to think like a predator, but act like prey, that's exactly like, obviously mine is a very, very small amount of time in comparison. But the way that like your brain clicks into it, even with such a small amount of exposure to a person who is erratic, is insane.
And what's so
important, oh my gosh,
that we want to survive. It's a human nature to survive. It's a mammal's nature. We want to survive. I mean, I have a sick cat right now that will do anything to stay alive. And, you know, it's not a good thing for her to do because she's, you know, past that point. So there's this huge, huge life fight inside all of, inside many of us, unless we get into a dorsal vagal state of being so shut down and scared. But I feel like the field of psychology has complicated on some levels unintentionally, you know, trauma bonding, all of this. And this shows up in battered wife syndrome, battered children syndrome, trafficking. There's a way you do what you got to do to survive. And most of it, particularly when the power differential is so big, is you go to any cost to not piss that person off, but also to help calm them down because they're scary when they're ungrounded.
Right.
Sorry. Yes.
And I think the narrative that we put on that too, like, I survived, you know, we survived. It shouldn't be a negative, like, I survived because I did this, or I survived because I did that. Like, just the fact that we survived whatever we had to do to get through it is, it should be enough.
I love this. I could go on and have this conversation with you guys and geek out forever. I know that we do have to stop at some point, but I could speak for Kara and I when I say I would love to have you both back at some point in future seasons to talk more about this and the research that you're doing. Tell us where we can find you guys right now, and how can we help without knowing anything about the families and maintaining that confidentiality? How can listeners support the JACE Foundation?
Well, the one thing I know you guys, really this Polyvagal Equine Institute, so there's the JACE Foundation of direct service, but this thing of creating these videos to help people that are going to testify and things like that, that's right now like our burning passion. And one of the things that we didn't talk about, so have us back, we'll talk all about horses for hours, is one of the things that horses have this ability to really tune into another person, to a human being, another mammal's nervous system. And on some level, they almost are appeasers unless they get into a place of being unraveled. So it's really, we really want your listeners to know about this, these videos. We're going to do a workbook to go along with it because we really want to help people get, be able to go into the stand and testify if they want. If they don't want to, I'm with you. Let them walk out the door. They don't have to.
So you can find us at the polyvagalequineinstitute.com and also the jacefoundation.org. We're doing all types of videos on there. And we're also going to have a course on Polyvagal Institute pretty soon.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And strictly, we're just trying to respect y'all's time. That's why we're...
Yes.
But we know you have a heart out. So that's why we're like... So last question, because we are Survivor's Guide to True Crime, we are creating different true crime content by survivors, about survivors, for survivors. We have to ask you, do you consume true crime content?
I do not. I can't. I feel like I can't watch it. I don't consume it. So no.
Yeah. No. It is a funny question. Dr. Bailey?
Well, I watch an awful lot of Law and Order Special Victims. I find it really reassuring. I have gotten into Crime Junkies recently because I'm just so interested in the whole the whole thing around it. But mm-hmm. I don't like, you know what? It's really weird. I can watch real crime stuff more than like, I don't like movies about like violent crimes, and I don't like anything about torture. That freaks me out. And yeah. I hate vampires. Yeah.
and vampires. Don't like them.
All right. Yeah, we're going to differ.
Yeah. Kim can no longer be your friend because her favorite movie.
Wait a second. I got to tell you something. A very, very famous producer who's no longer on this world. He and I had this big discussion about vampires, and you may not like them after this, Kimberly. They are the only perpetrator that turns their victims into perpetrators. And he believed, and he was an older man, very smart man. and he believed that they were really symbolized sexual abuse, right? That
Damn
it really
it.
Was a metaphor for sexual abusers.
Okay, I'm having an existential crisis here, so I'm going to need you to stay on and I'll bill you hourly because my favorite genre is Twilight. What are you doing?
Kim literally won a contest for being the biggest Twilight fan, guys. She was proud about it.
I like Twilight too.
That's why you're supposed to do your research before you open your mouth.
This actually might have a lot to do with it. I'll talk to you afterwards.
So much to unpack.
Now that is such an interesting concept, though. Well, thank you guys both so much for being here, for taking the time to talk to us, supporting what we're doing. But at the same time, we cannot tell you enough great things about the work that you continue to do and the people that you are as a representative of just survivors in general. You're doing amazing work, and we are so thankful that you're doing it.
Yeah.
Agreed. Thank you, guys. You too. Back at you.
Yeah, right back at you.
All right. We'll talk again soon. I know.
Absolutely.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain.
If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show.
To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com.
Thanks for listening.
Well, see you later.